Beano's checked out.
Beano has checked out. Let me see what happened to Beano.
Beano had some bourbon.
Let me ask Beano now. Beano, are you back? Beano. Okay. Doug and Jaxie, give me the sense of what the atmosphere was like in that place. From the Missouri crowd looked like they were flat, divided, wanted to get it over with. That was the sense we got looking at it. What was it like in the stadium?
Well, yeah, pretty much. Basically, I flew out of about 9 a.m., got to St. Louis about 12:10. On my way to Columbia, about a two-hour drive, I saw maybe five Missouri Tiger cars on the way.
Wow.
Yeah, not a lot, you know. I saw a couple of magnets on the car, a couple of their Tiger tails coming out of their bumpers or their trunks or whatnot. Get to the stadium. Well, actually, just student section, you know, they're off all week, so their last day of classes, I guess, were Friday. So several students were gone. I ended up parking a stone's throw away from the stadium at a frat house, and basically, you know, their lot that they were trying to sell wasn't even full. Was able to sit in the Tennessee section, but yeah, it was kind of amazing when we looked, and it was certainly not full, not close to full. I was in, obviously, like I said, I was in the Tennessee section, and the upper deck on the opposite side was pretty much desolate, and from basically the 30, 20, 10-yard line stands, not a lot of people there, sparse at best. Honestly, when we were on defense, I felt that our Tennessee section was pretty much just as loud as the Missouri section of the whole stadium compared to that. I mean, and all the folks sitting around me were just kind of amazed at how low energy the crowd was, you know. I guess if I put a political thing, you know, I'll be Donald Trump and say they were Ben Carson and Jeb Bush, you know, when it comes to low energy, because, you know, we were sitting there, and in fact, I told one of the fans beside me, I go, wow, when we played Western Carolina, we put 100,000 in there, and they can't put 40,000 in for Gary Pinkel's last game, and he's arguably the best coach they've ever had.
You know, that's really interesting, and that kind of speaks to what Beano was talking about before, which is there seems like with that Missouri fan base, he didn't get that heroic send-off that Frank Beamer got today up there in Blacksburg. Russell, that's really curious to me because Missouri was kind of lifeless tonight. Now, Tennessee took the life out of them, and Tennessee sucked, did not give them an opportunity to really get their hooks into the game from a momentum standpoint. But what you're telling me right now is really, really interesting, I do believe, Doug and Jaxie.
Yeah, I'll go on and speak to that. Like I said, I was there, and I kind of was able to get a pulse of what was going on, and I was able, you know, where I parked. I parked at a frat house. They weren't even able to sell all the spots that they were able to sell. In fact, the guy that came in and took my money to park, he said, "Man, just don't kill us too bad tonight because we suck." And you know, it wasn't like, you know, hey, you know, it's Gary Pinkel's last game. Hey, you guys better watch out. And almost all the Missouri fans that I had some interaction with was, you know, I would say, you know, 70% of them was, you know, don't beat us too bad tonight. And obviously, as a Tennessee fan and all the heartbreak that we've gone through, it's kind of like, hey, if we win, I'm going to be happy. But you know, there was obviously excitement on some of the fronts, but there just wasn't anything in the atmosphere as you're walking to the stadium with thousands of people going, you know, hey, let's win this one for Gary. We got to do this for Gary. It was more of just like, you know what, it's just been a kind of a disappointing season, and let's just kind of get this over with, and maybe we give Tennessee a great game. And I'm thinking, you know what, guys, you know, I'm thinking to the Missouri fans, I'm like, hey, guys, we've never beat you guys. You know, I mean, why are you guys so underconfident? You should be thinking, we've beaten Tennessee every time we've played them, so now we have them at home, and it's senior night, and it's Gary's last game, and just, there just wasn't any of that. There just, when I was in the stadium, there just wasn't a lot of energy. When we were on third downs, when we were on offense on third downs, you know, we're kind of looking at each other going, wow, this place really is not that loud. It's not that intimidating. We're thinking like, man, thank God that we're not these fans, because, you know, and then you know, obviously I've been several games in Neyland, and you go, wow, what a difference Neyland makes and this place makes for 2015, because it was just there's high school games that are more of an intimidating atmosphere. It was absolutely zero intimidation. When it was third down for Tennessee, I could turn to the guy next to me and, you know, I could whisper to him and he could hear me. But if, you know, if you were in Neyland Stadium, you couldn't yell and the guy beside you here. You know, it was just very flat line, dead. And, you know, they're north of us. It's cold. It's windy.
We misread that game, didn't we?
Yeah,
Russell.
I was terrified about this. I thought there was a good chance.
I was amazed at how flatlined and just dead the crowd was. Wasn't a lot of excitement walking through the stadium. And, you know, I'm still in Columbia now. I'm sitting in the parking lot. Not a lot of people walking around. There's just, you know, it's just kind of like, it's just kind of an atmosphere here in Columbia. And, you know, kudos to Tennessee, because, you know, this could have been certainly, you know, could have been a game to where we go in flat and we just, you know, and honestly, I mean, offensively, we were able to move the ball, but we had to settle for three, and then we had to settle for three again, and then we had to settle for three again. And just, I mean, just the defense tonight was just lights out. I mean, I was just so proud of the defense, the way that they just played the game. You know, I mean, the offense, I mean, for a night that Dobbs struggled throwing the ball, obviously, and he didn't do that much running the ball, and for us to still be able to at least be in the red zone and putting points on the board, you know, it just kind of shows, I think, that we had an overall, you know, obviously the defense played great, and the offense kind of played ho-hum besides Jalen Hurd that played really well, and obviously Alvin, whenever he gets the ball, he's going to do really well. But, man, the special team just, I think, kind of shows how important the special team is. With Trevor Daniel getting those punts, you know, I mean, Missouri just, they just never had anything, you know, positive on offense except for the one score. I mean, and us as fans, you know, and over in the section, we're just thinking, hey, we're going to shut them out. We're going to shut them out. And then to hold them to eight, you know, it's, you know, we would like to got it shut out. But to hold them to eight, but then, you know, just the whole night, it just, Missouri's offense, we just never felt that they were even capable of doing anything productive.
No. In fact, Doug, I thought, as we're watching the game at Cassie's tonight, we were looking at each other going, how many more times is this team going to get the ball over midfield? I mean, at one point, it looked like they were going to struggle to get the ball over midfield. And I know this. When you're attacking Tennessee's defense and you don't attack us down the field and you try to attack us laterally with the athletes they have, I harbored no fear that they were going to move the football downfield against our defense. That was just a mismatch from the word go. But I want to go back to how Beano said earlier, and he can articulate this a lot better than me since he's back from the John. Beano, and we're live here on the Smartway Dalton Behring Hydraulic fifth quarter fan reaction. Beano, you're now back from the John, and we've all been there before. And here I thought my phone line said, you were making me get, I was starting to cuss Comcast again, but it was just Beano's overactive bladder. Beano, share with Doug the sentiment that you had with me, because you are a very perceptive little bugger. Go ahead, Beano.
You know, Doug, with all of the intangibles out there, with them playing for bowl eligibility and Pinkel's last game and, you know, the supposed unity of the team and the weather and all, there was every reason for that to be a celebratory type of night. And that's just not what it looked like to me. It looked like they had lost their fan base, at least was a portion of them. And when the best coach in the history of program is going off the field in his last game due to illness to an empty house, that just tells you all you need to know right there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you know what? When the game ended, and they kind of did a little video tribute to him, you know, us as Tennessee fans, and I tried to get the folks around me to, you know, stand up and clap and give Gary Pinkel, you know, the respect that he deserves. But yeah, there just wasn't a lot of Missouri fans around that. It just seemed like they just were kind of like, even the ones that were still there, and obviously, you know, 55 or 60 or 70% of them had already left, but even the ones that were there, you know, they just weren't really that excited. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, it was the whole game. You know, if I could describe the Missouri fans from the folks that I met in the parking lot to the folks that I met on the street to the folks in the stadium, it was kind of like, That's how I would describe them as,
Hey, we thought it was going to be rabid there tonight. I was scared to death of this game.
You know, and I was too. And in fact, you know, like I said, I flew from Jacksonville this morning. And, but a week ago when I was planning to come here, I said, you know, I called the University of Tennessee to get tickets because I said, you know what? I don't want to take a chance on showing up there and trying to find some tickets. But obviously, you know, when you got in there, I was like, oh wow, I probably could have, you know, somebody probably could have gave me some tickets. And, but, yeah.
How many empty seats, Doug, would you guess there were in that place?
Well, you know what? Now, if you watched the game, obviously you guys did, and I was in the Tennessee area section, and obviously there was a lot of Tennessee people that I think, because when I called early in the week, there was only just maybe 10 tickets left, and I was getting a few last tickets, but even the Tennessee section, because of the weather, there was plenty of room. But when I looked across, the upper deck was sparse, if I could describe it as sparse, and then from maybe the 50-yard line and the 40 and the 30, maybe 85-90% full, but from the 20-yard line and the 10 and the goal line, I'll probably say 10% full. So not a lot of Missouri fans on that opposite side of the field, on their home side, but on the side that I was on, you know, it looked like it was a decent crowd. But I mean, if this place holds 60,000, I would probably estimate maybe 40,000 were there.
Gosh,
you know, they have their little area.
Seats.
Well, they have their little area, where the big M is in the rocks, and they allow people to kind of hang out over there. I mean, it was sparse, but you know, certainly in the fourth quarter, when your coach that's been there for so long and is arguably the best coach you've ever had, I mean, there was probably 50-50 Tennessee and Missouri people. And like I said, I was trying to, you know, as a Tennessee fan, show some respect to Pinkel and trying to get the folks around me, you know, to show that respect for him as well. Cause, you know, I kind of felt bad for him, just because so many people had left. And like I said, it just wasn't, you know, it wasn't the electric atmosphere that I was kind of anticipating with a senior night, and you've got a lot of seniors. You know, I think they said there was 21 seniors, you know, and in his last game, and he's been there for so long. I mean, if you can kind of compare him, you know, maybe the Philip Fulmer's last game, and like I said, I'm looking at people, I'm going, you know, folks beside me, I'm going, wow, we played Western Carolina and put 102,000 people in here, and they can't put 45,000 in for their best coach of all time's, you know, final game.
Wow. Doug,
and
thank you.
On,
You're welcome. You brought it to the table tonight, man. Thank you, brother.
All right. Have a good night, guys. Thanks
and
a lot.
You got us a W. You got us a W. Right. You got us a W. Thank you.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
As Ted Frump says, Doug is representing the Jacksonville contingent of Vol fans very well on this call. Great Vol support in sunny, beautiful Jacksonville, Florida. Coach Wilson says, spent a month in Missouri and Kansas last May. Those are some odd folks out there. Bino, I think you're right. I think that fan base, when he lost control of that team, put it this way. I'm going to go back to this again. I don't think Gary Pinkel was going to quit at the end of this year. I think that whole thing with the football team exacerbated whatever, sped the clock up, however you want to put it. Now, I'm not saying he doesn't have the diagnosis that they say he has. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying I find it hard to believe that a couple days later he was resigning. Was he going to resign if they didn't walk out on strike?
And I'll say again, Tony, I believe Gary Pinkel knew he was quitting, and that's why it was so easy for him to side with his football team against the college administrator. With little or no evidence that there was any real reason for any of that to happen.
But Gary Pinkel, to your point, his resigning, but even more to the point, the way those players walked out, I think it made that fan base, a bunch of them, say, you know what? It's going to be cold. I don't feel like it.
No question.
And I don't think if those kids didn't walk out, I don't think it would have been the same. So in retrospect, and this is the thing that you just don't know about games like this, and this is why college football is so interesting. Dubsy, in one respect, what we thought was going to create uncertainty actually ended up playing into Tennessee's favor. And that is really interesting because everybody on our side of the ledger, everybody on our side of it, misread it. Everybody. They had an empty house tonight and they were a dead and lifeless football team. That nobody anticipated. They were a divided fan base who said, you know what, it's going to be cold. These guys quit on us. Screw it. We're quitting on them. And that's what happened tonight. Go ahead, Dubsy.
I don't know how dead and lifeless they were. I mean, they were obviously fired up for Pinkel last week. It looked like they were
game was in Kansas City last week, and it's special.
It looked like they were flying around early. I think Tennessee is just a dominant team. I think they played the better game, and I think it was obvious by the end of the first quarter that they were going to win the game, and I think that Missouri kind of laid down at that point. I think Tennessee took the wind out of their sails.
Let's get our next call in. Smartway Dalton Bearing Hydraulic, fifth quarter fan reaction. And let's get our next call in. Hello and welcome in.
Hey, guys, it's JJ.
Hey, AJ.
Tony, are you on an earpiece? All right. Well, I guess Tony didn't think that was too funny, but thanks for us for the laugh. I think it's funny because, Tony, you seem kind of agitated by earpieces lately. So I thought it was a very good win. I was scared going into it. And going on the road and snapping this little winning streak, I think is crucial considering we had a chance or have a chance to be 8-4 and go to a bowl game and a fairly decent bowl game and be 9-4 and beating a team, maybe ranked in the top 25. So we could have choked it away, but we won. So I was impressed with this.
It was extremely impressive. I mean, in light of everything that this Tennessee football team has been through, they easily could have packed it in earlier in the year. I mean, three rip your heart out football games that went down on these guys. And man, they came out tonight and took care of business. Randy Bachman style, you know, Jim Turner style. And the truth about this bunch is you ain't seen nothing yet. Because I think next year's team, the best is yet to come. But they really got it right between the eyes earlier. It was like a stone gate, you know, earlier in the year. And I really do think that through my big brown eyes, that we ain't seen nothing yet, man.
I didn't get a chance to call in when Bino was holding it down. And usually, like 95% of the time, I agree with Bino. But I'd like to talk about the turf issue if you guys aren't sick of it yet. Because my take is that I'd like to look at every single point, and for every point, I would be in favor of the grass. And I was really disappointed to hear Bino chastise Paizan for, you know, saying what he felt was best, and he was saying that he was only doing it for nostalgia. For one, nostalgia, you ask people at Fenway Park when they were wanting to tear that down and build something new, you can't buy nostalgia. And I know that we haven't always had grass, but nostalgia does come into the equation. And to me, if there's a very real chance from what I've seen on TV about safety issues. And I mean, I found it really hard to listen to that a lot of people were just kind of yucking it up like you're some pink Okami if you have any concern for people's health when it comes to man-made stuff out there on the field. I don't take that lightly.
JJ, are you talking about the cancer issue?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or are you talking about injury?
No,
JJ, I'm not one of the foremost toxicologists in America, but I do know that in limited exposure periods with no known route of entry, you're not going to get cancer. Now, if you're grinding those tires up, that's a different deal. Nobody's going to get cancer playing 6 football games on ground-up tires. It can't happen.
People who are talking about staph infection and getting sick, that's not legit?
I don't know about staph infection. I'm talking about cancer. Whoever said you're going to get cancer from playing on ground-up tires is working for a grass seed company.
I mean, I think, have you seen that 30 for 30 special, whatever it was, with the turf fields and soccer, and those, the athletes are constantly, you know, in contact with that surface and with all the chemicals that go along with that, that there's, as far as the ratio of kids coming down with cancer, to me was high enough to be concerned. And we haven't seen this play out, so we don't know definitively if it's not, but if it is a risk, why not stay with grass? And the more and more people that are going to turf, to me, is in your favor marketing-wise to say, we still have grass. And I think there would be a lot of kids that, I mean, I find it very sloppy reasoning to say, well, all the kids want turf. Well, not all the kids want turf, just like it's very sloppy to say all scientists believe this or all Christians believe this, you know.
JJ, I didn't say all the kids wanted turf, and I'm a grass fan. I would prefer that we have grass. My only point was, when I try to come up with reasons of why I want grass, it always goes back for me to just romanticism, because the game of football is not negatively affected by turf. As a matter of fact, it's probably enhanced.
I think the grass,
except for when the ball hits the ground. It's not like baseball.
But natural, I would think natural grass, you're not going to get your cleats caught in it as much as you would find the turf.
I believe the modern turf is a little bit safer. I'm not saying you won't have. I haven't noticed any decrease in injuries in Tennessee's program since 1994.
I mean, I hear you on that. I just think that you can, if with all the money that we have in our budget, you can keep up.
I agree with that.
You can keep up the grass. You can even keep it up the grass for these minor type of, you know, these jamborees or whatever, even double headers. You could do that even with that. And the whole thing with trying to make it attractive to kids in the wintertime, I thought Tony's point was very commonsensical. It's like, hey, it's winter. Grass is dead in winter. And I don't think a kid is going to choose a school based on that. And if they do, I don't want you because you're, that's so stupid. So
no, I think that's nonsense too.
Yeah. So I think that maybe sometimes, you know, with anything, the pendulum can swing too much one way. And I think maybe it came across to me that you're almost overcompensating for sounding like an old, you know, old school.
I got that too, Bino. I was very disappointed in you. No, I'm not picking at you. But your capitulation to the kids, I mean, when does it end? What about what's right for the game?
Because it doesn't negatively affect the game.
Absolutely it negatively affects the game. It doesn't look like football. There's no grass and dirt.
Right. No, it's aesthetic.
What we saw Tennessee playing on in North Texas is bad for football. No, that's false.
I don't. Well, those aren't my two choices. Those aren't my two choices. That's like saying, let's not fire Derek Dooley. Who are you going to get? I'll get anybody but him. I want anything but that field last week, obviously. Let me throw something to you that Danny Parker wrote InsideTennessee.com. Bino and Dubsy, and this because we're picking this this turf thing up will be talked about this week coming up. He wrote a tremendous piece about what's going on in Neyland Stadium. How about this, guys? Nobody talks about this. Ole Miss has fake turf, and they're killing it in recruiting. They have fake turf, and they plan to rip it up after the season. Nobody tells you that. The Denver Broncos tried a hybrid grass recently with grass and turf, and they're ripping it up. They spent seven figures to go back to a pure natural surface. Talk out of Lexington is that Commonwealth Stadium's move to field turf is not going to last long, and they installed it prior to this season. They're already talking up there about how they want to go back to grass. Hey, guys, that field turf is not the panacea that you and Sean Sinclair think it is, Bino. I'm sorry. It's not. And quit sucking up to these kids, damn it. It's not the right thing to do.
My point was, Tony, if I'm going to give something to the kids, I'd rather it be a surface they want to play on rather than Little John or something like that.
Those kids are going to play at Tennessee not because of the grass or artificial turf. They're going to play because we're a winning program. And they come to the game and they see 100,000 plus against Western Carolina. When they see us play a rivalry game and all the excitement and emotion and all the hostesses, I mean,
I agree with you, but if they don't fix that surface, they're going to lose recruits.
Well, that's where the conversation to me needs to go. This is stupid to let Butch Jones
exactly
the program
exactly
about how he wants it. Say, hey, dude, is $3.5 million not enough? And all this work that you've done on the recruiting trail not enough? You're going to leave. Now, like Tony said, like, you know, we, even though he's kind of a buffoon in game, I don't trust their decision on getting a coach. But at the same token, if he's going to take his ball and go home over the grass situation, then let him.
Well, nobody said that, but he wants to have a green grass 24/7. And Dave Hart needs to be a leader for once in his life instead of a bully of women.
Here's the contradiction, though.
Go ahead.
For Butch Jones, he's afraid that having brown grass in January is going to negatively impact recruiting. Well, what about having
SEC Network and ESPN commentators rip your field on national television during actual games. How is that not negatively affecting recruiting?
Well, the problem with him, though, is...
We won't have a crappy field like that. We'll take better care of it.
And the problem is his athletic director didn't go to him and say, Butch, last year, look, I know for a fact, because the guys told me right to my face, the two experts that are in the news now, told them, you can't grow grass 24/7, 365, and it not impact your playing surface. They knew that. The athletic director should have gone to him and said, Coach, I'm really glad you want it this way. Unfortunately, you're not God. God is going to determine when the grass grows and when it grows dormant.
Yeah.
And they overseeded it with that rye, and they made it slicker than a hockey rink.
Bobby Campbell, the mythic figure, the grassmaster,
who came
descended
over there
from the skies into Neyland Stadium this week.
Correct.
And said that they're doing everything right.
Correct.
That everything's fine.
They brought Bobby Campbell over there because Bobby Campbell was out there telling people, and I'm just gonna call it what it is. He was saying some things that weren't true, and he walked away from it going, "Oh, the coach wants that thing green, 365
can't
and 247. Can't do it." Fulmer, in his recruiting, see, this is where you need an athletic director to worry about something other than bullying women. If you had an athletic director to worry about something other than bullying women and bullying disenfranchised people, you would have gotten somewhere. He's too afraid to stand up to his coach, and now he's in hiding.
Well, you want to recruit?
You know what he did this week?
The field looks like while it's painted.
You know,
take a picture of it. Show it to him.
You know what he did this week? He took three underlings, including that Welton guy, and brought him into his office and browbeat those guys and said, "You people better quit talking to the media behind my back about this field issue." That was Dave Hart's. That's how he solved the problem. He is a punk and a clown. And, JJ, thank you for dragging me into that.
And, JJ, I'm actually a grass advocate, but
I am
just playing devil's advocate. I've heard too much over the last couple of weeks.
You're worn down.
That if we go away from grass, that Tennessee's program will never be the same again. Nonsense. Tennessee's program's been good on grass and artificial surface.
Well, Beano, Kentucky's talking about going away from it. Ole Miss is going away from it. Denver Broncos went away from it. And more teams, it's not the panacea people think it is. And if I had my way, we would be smoking grass and we'd be playing on it. Get you some of that. Because I would legalize it in both cases. And I would illegalize smoking fake grass and playing on fake grass. Dubs, you have a thought on that? It should be illegal to smoke fake grass, and it should be illegal to play on fake grass. Do you have a thought on that, Dubsy?
Fake
and
grass,
I would legal and
the stuff that the honey badger was smoking.
And I would, there you go, you made it work for me. And I would legalize.
Speaking of good on grass,
smoking and real grass.
And we must be smoking crack to still be on here.
Let's get our final caller in here. Hello and welcome in as we crack the three-hour mark after a scintillating victory by the Volunteers.
Bino's going to have to hit the John again here if we keep this up.
Hey,
interesting.
Tom Hanks in a league of their own. It had nothing on me a minute ago.
Let's get our next call in. Hello and welcome.
Hey, Tony, how are you guys doing tonight?
Hey, doing great. Thank you.
Hey, this is Sean Galley, gentlemen. Hey, I just wanted to point out a couple of things. One was, and Tony, I'm with you on this. This is a really impressive win tonight.
Great win.
We had, I mean, think about previous years. I mean, we had a better team than this team, than this Missouri team last year. We had every excuse in the book to come in here and go, oh, man. You know, they're really pumped for this game. And I know that they got deflated real quick, but if you watch, because I just started rewatching the game, and if you watch them, man, they're really trying to get pumped up. Two quick turnovers to start the game, man. Tennessee just kind of wore them down after that. And that's what the good teams do. It's what the good staffs do. I mean, we've been tough on Butch, and rightfully so, because he's done some questionable things, we'll call it. But tonight, man, I'm with you. We got to give credit where it's due. He went out there. He had his team prepared. He had his team ready to go. It was going to be ugly. You went in there and you dominated a well-coached team, which is something that we haven't seen here in a long time. Tony, I'm 30. It's been a third of my life since I've seen Tennessee do stuff like this. This feels good, man. It feels really, really good.
Man, I love it, and it should feel good because the truth is it's getting ready to come back. And tonight, that is a telltale sign to me. When you go out there and you go on the road and you go into a place like that where you've had no success and you're really not able to get your passing offense off and you still dominate this team and blow them out like that, and it might not have been a blowout on the scoreboard, but it was a blowout in every other way, shape, and form.
They dominated that game.
Absolutely.
From start to finish. I mean, and you saw it with Tennessee. You saw it on their defense. And, I mean, one thing, you know, we haven't talked too much about, but the two takeaways to early in the game, huge.
No question.
I would love to see Tennessee rip at the ball more. Because that's one thing I see the LSUs, the Bamas, the ones that are good and in it every year, they rip at the ball every chance they get. I would love to see us do that a little bit more. But it gets you really excited. And I do disagree with you a little bit on Iowa. Let's get them in a bowl game again this year. I would love to be able to drop a 60 burger on them this year, man.
I'm telling you about Iowa. They are a fraud. And if we get our hands on them, we'll rip them apart just like we did last year because they don't play. And I speak for Bomani Jones when I say this. They are whiter than tap powder, brother. And Ebony and Ivory will not live in perfect harmony on that football field. And I speak for Bomani Jones when I say that.
Watch an SEC game and then watch Iowa.
No question.
Finish an SEC game, watch how quick everybody is, how fast everybody is, and then go watch Iowa. It's like watching a game in slow motion. Man.
No question. It's like slow motion, or it's even like rewind. It's like the difference between rewind and fast forward.
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, isn't that mainly the same team from last year?
Absolutely.
I don't know anything about Iowa.
So no, it's the same junk team they had last year.
I mean, and here we are a year older, a year stronger. I mean, and again, give credit to the staff, man. They developed these guys' strength. I mean, this team is starting to really look like an SEC team. Today, they went into Missouri with every excuse to come in and with a losing mindset. This team, it's not there. It's definitely not. But it's starting to build that winning mindset.
Yep. You know, like Dubsy said, you put six wins last year, eight this year, and now, I'm already counting. You got seven wins right now. You know, you hope against hope next week. The way things go around here, we might have, you know, might get a hold of some bad bird next week, you know. And
somebody sent me a thing on Twitter saying that Tennessee is still mathematically alive to make the Sugar Bowl this year. It had to do with, like, all the teams in the West, besides Alabama, all have, like, four losses.
Oh, so you're second in the East.
Place. And, like, if Florida loses to Florida State and then loses in the SEC championship game, they would have three losses. It's possible that the Sugar Bowl could take Tennessee. It's possible.
Do you know how many tickets the Sugar Bowl was? I mean, let's speak about Florida for a second. Did you guys see how empty Florida Stadium was today? Did anybody notice that?
Oh,
it's been that way all year. It's been that way for about 2 or 3 years.
They are wrapping up a glorious season.
9-1.
And they had thousands of empty seats today. Who do you think the bowl committee would take if they had a choice and they're not in front of the cameras. I'm talking about behind closed doors. If they had a chance between Tennessee and Florida, and they could pick.
Hey, if Tennessee goes to the Sugar Bowl, can we do the first ever fifth quarter remote? We take the show to NOLA. Do it on the Bourbon Street.
You got it.
Let's do it.
I just yawned. You got it, man. You got it.
Fifth quarter from the French Quarter.
You got it, Bino.
Well, what bowl committee really doesn't want Tennessee there? Especially
no question.
Where the fans are going to be traveling. You know this year they're going to be traveling just like they did last year.
We bombarded that deal last year. No doubt about it.
And, you know, I kind of synced up with the radio to listen in because I feel like you can get a better read of the crowd than you can on TV. That crowd stayed dead.
Yep.
I mean, that crowd was that. I mean, they had a bunch of people just like that guy you were talking about earlier fell asleep watching the game. They all fell asleep watching the game.
Yeah, that first of all, Tennessee put the cold shot on them, to quote Stevie Ray Vaughan, and it was a snoozer from the very beginning.
It was.
But their crowd, I'm with Bino. There's an untold story there, at least that we don't know about. That's a divided deal. It's a bunch of people that said to heck with it. And why are there students out? Why would their students be out a week before Thanksgiving? That doesn't make any sense.
Well, apparently they're getting a fall break that's starting now.
What?
And I guess a lot of them decide to go home. I mean, that's my only thought because SEC's got to be counting the days for Missouri to stop being relevant.
Fall break the week before Thanksgiving.
That's embarrassing, man. And SEC, that's a team that's won two SEC East titles. And and you could see it on the TV, man. Your caller earlier said 10% student section. That might have been generous. I mean, there was a few people in that section, and that's it. So, that was bad. I mean, and talking about Florida, because if Georgia gets rid of Mark Richt, I mean, you were talking about earlier between Florida and Tennessee. I mean, that's how many arrests has Florida had? I feel like that program is going to be in trouble here if that keeps up.
Did you say arrests?
Yeah, they've had half dozen arrests or guys.
I think that's a sign that good things are happening for you when you get arrests.
That's good recruiting in Florida, I guess.
But anyway, thanks for the call. I wish I was kidding, but unfortunately, it seems like the worse you are with the police, the better you are on the football field. But thank you, man. Good talking to you.
Hey, thanks, Tony. Gentlemen, have a good evening.
You're outstanding. Hey, outstanding. Bino, give me a final thought. You went wire to wire tonight, gavel to gavel, Bino.
Tony, I just thought it was a really, really satisfying win, where we got another opportunity to see that this program is taking a step. And who would have thought going into Georgia that we would be sitting here talking about an opportunity to win 8 football games if we can take care of business against Vandy. So I think we're learning. I think we're improving. And I thought tonight was really satisfying.
Dubsy, final thought.
Yeah, I mean, like I said earlier, you're looking at 8-4. The SEC is changing. Georgia is in a state of transition. Tennessee's caught them or passed them, arguably. South Carolina's headed back down from where they've been under Spurrier. Missouri's headed back down from where they were their first 2 years in the league. Kentucky and Vanderbilt are still Kentucky and Vanderbilt. Tennessee is next year, Tennessee should be right there with Florida, just like they were back in the glory days, competing to win the SEC East. So, you got a chance to go 8-4 next week and maybe win 9 games this year. That's a solid step in the right direction.
Guys, been a lot of fun. Bino, thanks, man.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you.
See, thank Bino. You. Bino's the best. Dubsy, tell the living listener where they can find you.
Weekdays, 3 to 6 on WKGN 1340 here in Knoxville. You can listen online at sportsradioknoxville.com. And give me a follow on Twitter at Russell the Drive.
And for Dubsy and all those behind the scenes, my final word is you can feel it. You can feel it.
Coming in the air tonight.
It is coming. It is absolutely coming. Could it have been this year? Sure. But it's coming. For my friends at Smartway, Dalton Behring Hydraulics, Tennessee Sports Medicine, everybody behind the scenes, this is Tony Basilio wishing you a wonderful night. I hope you have yourself a great Sunday. And, man, I'm blessed to be here. Go Vols, go.
Guest, because our next guest illuminated something that's near and dear to my heart and really shined the light on, I think, some underrated heroes in the history of rock and roll. And I didn't just say Southern rock. I said rock and roll. Mark Hrabowski's now joining. He is the author of Whiskey Bottles and Brand New Cars, The Fast Life and Sudden Death of Lynyrd Skynyrd. And Mark, I welcome you in. You also wrote a biography several years ago on Tom Landry that I loved and couldn't put down. I want to acknowledge that to you. And it is just so great to talk with somebody that's as gifted as you are. Man, I'm honored to have you today on Book Corner. Welcome in.
I don't know what to say. Thanks. Writing about these people, that's my life. I sort of almost transform myself into these people. It's the only way I can relieve my own mundane life. You know what I'm saying?
I can relate to that. A wise man once told me one time, Dick Schaap, as he wrote his memoir and was doing a book tour, and I said to him, Dick, you've been all around the world, you've dined with kings and queens, yet you keep coming back to the sports world, how do you do it? And he said, listen, every person that you visit with is going to have a story. I don't care who they are. And he said, some of the best stories I ever worked on were high school student athletes. And it got me thinking. And I'm just considering everything that Ronnie Van Zant was before they were quote-unquote discovered. And there was nothing in his past or lineage that said, this guy's going to be a rock and roll star, was there?
No, and if you think about it, you could probably say that about anybody who ever rose to that level of intellect and wisdom in music. They usually are judged as failures. This is almost like a constant theme when people talk about their childhood. Ronnie was a dropout. Hank Williams, who I'm writing a book about now, was a dropout in the 11th grade. These people were judged as losers, as failures. They'll never amount to anything. And this is also a common thing. Ronnie's own father thought he would be a failure. I have a book out now about Otis Redding, which is also in that Southern genre on the soul side, the R&B side. And his father was a minister, could not tolerate Otis singing that kind of race music, you know, non-religious music. But these people had to find their own way in life. And they did it through music, which is an unbelievably common thread when you look at some of the most talented people we've ever seen in this generation.
Ronnie's really underrated. And yeah, the band around him, they were incredible players. I love playing music myself. I played guitar for a couple decades plus. What I appreciate about Skynyrd is the more time you spend with their music, the more you realize how much was there. And you talk about Ronnie Van Zant as a lyricist. It's mind-boggling to consider how Sweet Home Alabama, you write a lot about in the middle of the book.
Right.
And, you know, it's a song that different sides of that issue project, this is what he's saying. No, this is what he's saying. No, this is what he's saying. That is some brilliant writing that he did. And, you know, the truth is, he didn't stay at the party long enough to tell us what he was saying.
Maybe we should give him credit for that. Maybe that was sort of like a hidden agenda. Like, if I keep people guessing about what I really mean in the song, they'll buy it on both sides of the political divide. Because now, even to this day, you have raging arguments over whether that's a right-wing song or a left-wing song. And Ronnie, who was neither, really, he was apolitical. It came from whatever he was feeling at the moment. And what he was feeling at the moment was he had to defend Southern manhood from Neil Young, the Canadian interloper who besmirched the honor of the Confederacy and the post-Confederacy and Southern manhood by writing Southern Man in Alabama. That was his impulse to write the song. But what came out of it, I agree with you. It's just so oblique. It's fascinating to try to analyze that song because Ronnie never probably put a second of analyzing into it when he wrote it. Ed King told me that. Ed, the guitarist at the time with Skinner, who came up with that great lick, you know, the opening lick, da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, that was Ed King. He wrote it with Ronnie. He said as soon as Ronnie heard the lick, he had almost a complete song in his head. Could you believe that? A song like Sweet Home Alabama, which said so many things to so many different people. But that's how Ronnie was. It was organic. It would just spring up. It'd be like an atom bomb exploding in his head. And another thing to remember is he never wrote down a single word of any of his songs on paper. He would come into the studio, it would all be in his head, and he would know exactly how he'd want the arrangement to sound when he started singing. You know, I've written about a lot of people in music. I may have a book coming out on James Taylor next year even, another brilliant songwriter. Nobody has ever done it the way Ronnie Van Zant did. I'm still trying to figure it out myself.
I'll make sure I understand that now. So yeah. They walk into a studio.
All in his head.
Big wheels keep on rolling. Carry me home to see my kin. Are you kidding?
All in his head. Ed King, who came from, you know, the Strawberry Alarm Clock, Incense and Peppermints, one of the most wordy songs written of all time, one of the most verbose, pretentious songs of the psychedelic rock era, helped to write that song. He comes into this situation now, where he's with a guy who doesn't even have a pen and paper, and he has the thoughts all in his head. He knows what he wants. He sings it back to Ed so that he could get the complete arrangement. They go into the studio in Doraville, Georgia, with Al Cooper, great producer, who worked with Bob Dylan and the Rolling Stones, and they're all flabbergasted that Ronnie has it all in his head. He could come in, he could run it down for them, they could get the sound levels, but it would all be in his head. And if it didn't sound right to him, he wouldn't do it. Otis Redding was that way too, by the way. When he'd go to Memphis, to Stax, to do some of those great soul hits, those songs were all in his head. Something like a pattern here with certain people being able to keep all these songs in their head and know exactly what they want to do with it.
In preparing for today, and I read your book cover to cover, anytime I'm going to talk to somebody, I think it's disrespectful. And I think authors can tell, because I've had several authors tell me, I can tell you read my book. Not only do I read the book, I like to look around and see what people are saying about the book. And then I also like to see if there are any other interviews out there. I noticed where you had said, people, I think, musically, they want to try and divide music. I think it's something that we all do. This is this genre, this is this. Hey, great music's great music. And we were talking before about some great soul and some things that you have a heart for and a love for. And speaking of Otis, you said when somebody asked you about Ronnie and some other contemporaries of Southern rock, you said, whoa, wait a second. He's closer to Otis than he is some of these other people that you think I'm going to name. Unpack that for me. Why do you feel that that's the case?
He was of a generation in North Florida that was in great transition in the 60s. They weren't like their fathers and their grandfathers. He's nothing like his father, Lacey, the truck-driving man who he wrote about, a hard-working man but never had a really an original creative thought in his head. Ronnie was of that generation in the 60s where all that was changing, where you could be a free thinker. You wouldn't have to think like your parents. And in Jacksonville at that time, again, in the throes of Jim Crow society, you know, very few blacks around, Ronnie was a great fan of soul music. You could hear it on the radio coming from Georgia, far end of the dial, the soul stations coming from Georgia. And he was a fan of Otis Redding. That was the music of the region. Muscle Shoals was like the mecca to these guys in Jacksonville. And Muscle Shoals was where all those Stax Volt records, you know, Wilson Pickett and Sam and Dave and Aretha Franklin. That's where that music was made. It must have been going to Mecca when Skinner's first recordings were made at Muscle Shoals. They weren't successful, but if you listen to them now, you hear the germination of this great band. They were coming together. They were very young and they were unfocused, but they still sort of knew what they wanted to do. So he had this love of soul music mixed in with his heritage, the music of his heritage. This is the old Confederacy we're talking about, which is being paved over by super highways and strip malls, and very little of that old Southern pride was left. So there was a whole different stream of impulses and thoughts and what he wanted to do with this music. And that's why it's so universal. They loved him in Japan. They got it in Japan. They got it in England. They got it in France. It was that universal.
And if you listen to it, it is a distillation of a lot of different influences from Hank Williams, from Merle Haggard. They covered Merle Haggard. They covered J.J. Cale. They were doing all these different things, but they still had time to do blues music. That's why Stephen Gaines came in later on. Ronnie loved him because he was a blues guitarist and a blues singer. So there's all these different forces going on in Skinner that people really didn't realize. They were anything but a redneck band. That's way, way too simple an explanation for what they were doing.
That's the thing that your work illuminated and why I couldn't put it down. Because the more I learned about Ronnie Van Zant Young early on, he was a fighter, pugnacious, would beat anybody up for looking at him crossways, cocky, arrogant. And he basically drugged these untrained musicians on a ride around the world with him through his will, his passion, his determination. You're talking about just a real, to use his term, a real to the world, simple man who was never intimidated, was he? It didn't matter what situation that guy was in, he was never intimidated.
He was a simple man on a lot of levels too, sort of like a backwoods intellectual. He was, but he always had that ballast. He always had that foundation of the Southern man and kin and God and family and moonshine and Saturday night dances and things like that. That was the heritage he came from, and he wasn't going to renounce it. There were great Southern bands too. I mean, the Allman Brothers and Alabama and 38 Special with Ronnie's brother, Donnie, Molly Hatchet, the Outlaws, Charlie Daniels. They all did something a little bit different than the other one. I don't think we've ever seen this. Writing about James Taylor, I got into that early 70s Southern California country rock culture. Sorry to say, I mean, it was great music, but there was a lot of it sounded exactly alike. People will disagree with me, obviously, if they want, if they feel that way, but that's my opinion. But when you look at the actual Southern rock, the actual country rock, the Dixie kind of hardcore Southern rock, I don't think any of those bands could be called similar, do you? At the beginning, when a lot of people were trying to reject Skinner, they would say, well, they sound too much like the Allman Brothers. They didn't sound anything at all like the Allman Brothers. The Allman Brothers would go off on 20-minute blues jams without a vocal, and they'd be great at it. And here's Skinner with 3-minute rock operas about the backwoods of the South. They were nothing alike. I think that's why that music stands up so well today. It's because everybody had something to say. I made the case in the book that the Southern songwriters were sort of the baby boomer carryover of the great literary set of the 20s, 30s, and 40s. You know, they were the new Fitzgeralds. They were the new Tennessee Williamses. They had something to say. And I don't think any part of the country, any region of the country can stand even close to the South when it comes to creating art from the heart and soul. The South stands by itself. And I only wish that they would realize it down there. I really do, because I don't think a lot of people do. They have a chip on their shoulder, and they always will for some reason. It's a weird dynamic.
Doesn't art, and you've studied a lot of great songwriters, that muse and where it comes from, pain, strife, difficulty, depression, joblessness, a lot of those things that probably would have defined Jacksonville in that time of transition, late 60s, early 70s. Losing the heritage, so to speak. Don't you think that was reflective in their music? And then part two, they were really soulful. That's what you helped me to see. Not only the soulful background, but Ronnie had a soulful bent. And now when I go back and whether it's the early stuff or it's the I Know a Little later on, there's just a lot of great soul in their music.
Oh, definitely. This is something you could say about all American, Native American music, that it really started to become an identifiable property when the great Delta blues musicians started leaving the South and coming north, the Robert Johnsons, the Muddy Waters. When they started leaving the South and coming to Chicago and St. Louis and then fanning out to both coasts, the people that Alan Lomax would write about and go to prison to interview, like Lead Belly, when those guys started making their music heard was when American music matured. Matured from the folk idiom that developed in the 1800s when the immigrants came over from Europe And it just developed in the mountains and the backwoods and in the Delta. And this is the music that really led to Skinner. Because, again, Ronnie loved rock and roll. He was a great Stones fan. Paul Rogers of Bad Company was his hero, his guitar hero, so to speak. But when he sat down and wrote, he couldn't help but integrate what he'd heard as a child from those great Delta blues musicians. And I could hear it. You could hear it, right? I mean, you could hear it. That's when rock and roll really started to grow up, I think. It started when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones started to co-opt these great American pioneers in soul, much more than America ever did. And then when America sort of said, we got to appreciate what we got, that's when you started